a wonderful Thursday evening, and the time is just about 7:30 p.m. That means it's time for Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, welcoming you to the show, a show where we explore Swami's message and lessons in the backdrop of the questions that you listeners pose to me. And thanks to all of you, the variety of themes that we have had the opportunity to explore on the show is indeed amazing. And there's so much more to learn too. Sometimes I do have to repeat a lot of explanations that I'd given for earlier questions, but that's good in a way too, because the issue might appear different, but the solutions may be something more fundamental. And repeating it is always a good way to keep reiterating to ourselves some of these very profound truths. That's how mananam is always performed, isn't it? Today's question too is one such. A part of what I'm going to say may be what I've said before, but the question, though pertaining to a unique situation, has some learnings that are very, very fundamental to the path many of us are treading. I'm sure the answer is going to be important to me, though it's not completely related to me. I hope it is important and relevant to a few of you listeners too. But before we get to the question, let us offer our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. And as always, start the show with an interesting quote. Today happens to be the International Yoga Day. And in fact, if you have not yet seen it on the website or if you go to our YouTube channel, you can see a short video of the event being celebrated in Prashanthi Nilayam, in the Indo Stadium and the various schools of Swami's institutions. The moment we say yoga, it's more than just a fitness regime, isn't it? It's a complete package for physical and mental well-being. In fact, I had a question on the show sometime back about the difference between physical exercise and yoga, and we had a comprehensive study of what yoga means. The underlying understanding of yoga is that there is a connection between the physical and mental health. And the quote I'm going to read is nothing but a reiteration of that fact. It's not a quote by a yogi, but an American politician. These are words of the 35th President of the United States of America, John F. Kennedy. I quote, "Physical fitness is not only one of the most important keys to a healthy body, it is the basis of dynamic and creative intellectual activity." End of quote. On the show, I once answered another question relating to clinical depression. In the course of the answer, I had explained how the sharpness and cheerfulness of the mind can be enhanced very drastically by keeping the body active. So there's enough proof today that fitness of the body does lead to a healthy mind too. So the next time you feel too sad or dull to do something physically active, well, let's go and do something physically active, because that's when we need it the most. And as Swami would say, without good health, we cannot do any sadhana whatsoever, nor can we be of service to others. So before we head to the question, dear listeners, permit me to read that quote by John F. Kennedy one more time. I quote, "Physical fitness is not only one of the most important keys to a healthy body, it is the basis of a dynamic and creative intellectual activity." Well, let's then head to today's show. As I said, I have a question. The answer that I wish to give for that may be a little repetitive, but I'm sure there will still be a lot of learning in the course of the answer. I'm hoping to finish the answer a little earlier than I usually do. I usually take the entire show to talk about the answer. I hope that I can finish the answer early, and at the end of it, I want to play for you a very, very beautiful and profound Padyam that Swami sings. It's a poem. I'll try and play it in Swami's own voice, and then I'll try to explain the meaning of that a little bit more in detail. But first, for the question, this week's question, it's a little more different, a little tricky. Let's listen to the question in her own voice. She wishes to be anonymous. We'll listen to the question and we'll see what answer we can come up with.
Sairam, Brother Prem. Firstly, I would like to express my gratitude to this wonderful program that you are presenting. Now my question. It's a rather long one. The question is short, but my story. I came to know Swami when I was 10 years old. When I was 17 years old, I met my future husband. When he came to my house for the first time before marriage, he saw the photos of Swami and said he did not like Sathya Sai Baba. He asked me to choose either to believe Baba or to decide to marry him. At that age, I said I won't follow Swami. We got married 6 years later. After having our first child, I became very depressed for several years. I tried doing yoga, pranayama, but nothing gave me the stability, happiness and courage to face the world. One thing led to another, and gradually I came back to Swami for guidance and confidence. 10 years after promising that I won't believe in Swami, I started reading books and online articles about Swami. 23 years after marriage, I decided to go for bhajans, get involved in activities of Sai organization and meeting like-minded people. My husband wants me to erase Baba from my mind and say and believe that he is not God. To me, this is like someone saying it is dark when it is full bright sunlight. My husband says I cheated him and I did not keep my promise of not believing in Swami. According to him, all the so-called gurus and swamis are fake. He gets very excited when a fake guru is exposed and will eagerly follow those stories and forward them to me. Going for bhajan, satsangs and meeting like-minded people gives me lots of peace of mind and happiness. Is this violation of dharma? Is this cheating? That is my question. If you could throw some light on it and to listen to a third opinion and in Swami's way, that would be great. Thank you so much, Saira.
So that's the question, and I'm sure most of you would find that question quite interesting. Quickly summarizing what the sister was conveying there, at the age of 17, she met her future husband who happened to be an agnostic, an atheist, especially not very fond of Swamiji's and Baba's. So when he got to know that her family believes in Swami, he extracted a promise from her that if she wishes to marry him, then she should give up the worship of Swami and not think of Swami and not follow Swami. So at that moment, she promised to do that. She got married and life went on for a while. Then came her what we refer to as the postpartum depression after her first childbirth. And one thing led to the other, and she finally found repose in Swami again. So she found herself turning back to Swami. And now 23 years after marriage, she feels the need to go to spend time with like-minded people, devotees of Swami, spend time in the Sai Center, which now has infuriated her husband, and who says that she has betrayed his trust. So is this a violation of dharma from the point of view of she not being able to keep up her word, and from the point of view of she being a dutiful wife, is she violating her dharma as a wife? So that's the question the sister has asked. Very interesting question indeed. Before I come to the actual issue, I'd like to talk something very generally about this idea about giving word to someone or promising someone something. Yes, we all must keep our word. There's no doubt about that. I'm not going to challenge that idea. The basic idea of morality itself is when we are able to stick to the word that we give another person, isn't it? Be it in business, in our professional life, or within a relationship. When we give a word, we need to lead our life in such a way that the other person can trust our word, right? That's the basic idea of morality and principles. Ethical living and values, or whatever you would like to call that. But I wonder if we completely realize what it actually takes to keep one's word. I'd like to dwell a little on this before we head to the actual question, actual issue in the question itself. I think to be able to give somebody a word or a promise and to hold on to that and live up to that, we must have enormous amount of control over ourselves. It's only in that situation it's possible to keep our word. And many times I would think of this, when we were students, when we would speak to Swami, we would often promise a lot of things to Swami, right? We would say, oh, Swami, we'll never leave you. We'll always be here with you. Swami, we'll, all kinds of things that we'll never forget you. And we'll, some of us would say that, Swami, we want to stay with you. We want to work here all our life. We're not bothered about money. We're not bothered about position. Right? At the age of 17, just like the questioner, we would promise a lot of things to Swami. And when we would say that to Swami, we would actually really mean it, right? It's out of devotion and out of immense love for Swami that we would say it. So in that sense, it would come out of real bhavam. And in a way, you can call that a promise that we're making to Swami. So sometimes Swami would respond by saying, oh, very good boy, and pat you and say bangaru and give us a pad namaskara, something like that. But many, many times Swami's response would be very different. If you go up to Swami and say, Swami, I want to always be with you and I want to serve you all my life, Swami would just hold a tuft of his hair. You know how beautiful Swami's halo of hair is. Swami will hold with his hands a tuft of his hair and he say, Inta mandi chusandra. Swami will say, meaning that I have seen so many people. The suggestion that Swami would make is, I have seen so many people who have come and promised me so many things. Very few have lived up to it, right? So Swami would say that don't, you know, make all these filmy dialogues to me. I've seen so many people. It's not easy to stick to your word, right? That's what Swami would say. So though we mean it when we give our word to somebody and when we promise things, to keep our word, it calls for an enormous amount of self-control. And that is something that I don't know how much we acknowledge that. And two things, especially Swami would speak of this, control over our senses. Swami would say that is very, very important to lead a truthful life. I think in one of his discourses in the 1990 summer courses, Swami speaks about that only when one has controlled one's senses, one can actually be truthful and just. And weakness of the senses, Swami would use a word for that, a term for that called karana apatvam. Right? That is one of the weaknesses of the senses. When the senses, in the most physical senses, physical interpretation of this, Swami would say that, you know, when you have malaria, the way your physical senses, function change, right? Your taste changes, or when you have some kind of defect in your eye, the way you look at things change. So you cannot go by what your senses are telling you, right? Swami would say that's the physical way of thinking it. The other way of it is when you have not controlled your senses, your discrimination is actually biased. You're not able to make right decisions. You're not able to do what you think you're supposed to do. Even if you made the right decision, to be able to do that is not possible. So one thing which Swami would say is, we need control of senses, not only the physical body, the senses also, and to a great extent, even the mind. And I think I've made a mention of this before. You know, when we go up to Swami and say, Swami, I'll do whatever you tell me to do, it's very easy for me to obey Swami's instructions, which are within my abilities, right? If Swami were to come here and tell me, you know, you sit down now, or Swami says, no, you stand up and do your program, or Swami says, no, you go and stand outside in the corner. All of these things I can follow because I have a fair amount of control over my body. And today being the yoga day, if Swami were to come and tell, name an exotic asana and say, do it, I can't do that. Even though I want to obey Swami, even though I have pledged my obedience to Swami, I cannot obey Swami because I don't have that control over my body. And even more difficult if Swami were to give me an instruction which relates to my mind. If Swami were to say, you know, you have to think only 5 thoughts a day, or you have to not think of certain things. How much ever I love Swami and how much ever I want to obey Swami, I cannot obey Swami because I don't have control over my mind to follow such instructions, right? So I can tell Swami that I will do whatever whatever you tell me to do, but I cannot do it unless and until I have absolute control over my physical and mental faculties. But of course, when it comes to Swami giving us a command, or when we're saying, Swami, I'll do whatever you tell me to do, and Swami gives a command, if there is the requisite surrender, as Swami would say, Swami will give us the ability to do it, even though we are not capable of doing that ourselves. When Swami gives us a command, Swami will also give us the ability to follow that instruction. Right? But that's a different point altogether. That's when Swami is the one to whom we are making a promise, and when we have complete surrender. So we'll not go into that aspect of it. But the general idea of when we give a promise to another person, when we give our word to another person, our ability to stick to that depends so much on our self-control, especially mastery over our senses and mastery over our physical faculties. And that's why Swami would always say this, that, you know, ethics and morality must have a spiritual basis. You cannot be an ethical person, a moral person, if you have not practiced spirituality to gain control over yourself. That's why Swami would repeatedly say this, especially during Samukha's discourses, that spirituality is the basis of moral living. So, though we must keep our word, and there are no two thoughts about that, it is not possible to do this unless we are in perfect control over ourselves. And that is why even when it comes to devotion, Swami would say that having love for Swami alone is not enough. You must learn to develop self-control and mastery over your faculties. So be it for an ethical moral living, be it for being a truthful and just person, or be it even for obedience in the realm of devotion, a certain amount of self-control is very, very important. That's one aspect of it. And going back to the question, in the question that you mentioned that you were 17 years old and you know, at that point you promised to your future husband that you would keep up this word, that, you know, the promise that he extracted from you. Now at the age of 17, and on top of that you are infatuated, the chances of you giving a word at that age under such circumstances and holding on to it is extremely, extremely thin. Because when you are under the influence of any kind of strong emotion, be it infatuation, be it anger, be it even immense happiness, you have to be very, very careful of what you say. There is a reason for this, because, you know, the nature of any such emotion, especially any strong emotion like this, is that it concentrates all our energy at that current moment, at that present moment or that present scenario. Isn't that one of the reasons when we are preparing for an exam, just that day before the exam or the last few hours before the exam, there's so much of pressure and so much of tension. We are so tensed about taking the exam. If you notice the way we start studying at that time, we get enormous amount of focus, right? Because that's the nature of any kind of intense emotion, be it extreme happiness or extreme worry or anxiety or anger. Any of these things make us live completely in that moment in a sense. You know, you don't think about the future possibilities which might occur. You don't look at the lessons that you've learned, I mean, lessons that you're supposed to have learned from your past mistakes. You are so drawn by that moment. That is why it is very, very, you should be very careful of what you do under the influence of any strong emotion, right? That's why they always say this, don't make any promise when you're very happy, or don't make any decisions when you're very angry, because it's not the right frame of mind to promise anybody anything or make any decision. So for one to keep one's word, one must have control over one's senses, and one must not have given that word under the influence of any strong emotion. That's very, very important, because once that emotion fades away, once that moment passes away, it is very, very difficult, right? That's why it's important that when we, and when we are even holding on to the promise that we have given, it's only these strong emotions which actually stop us from holding on to the promise that we have given, right? That's what always happens. When you're absolutely angry, or when you're absolutely carried away by the changes in life, that is when we actually forget the promise that we have given to the people. And there are many, many stories in our mythology which says about this, how promises are broken when a person is carried away by emotion, or even carried away by the rolling of life. As it goes, you forget it because there are other emotions which take over your life. So I'm not saying that it is okay to break promises, you've broken a promise, it's okay, it happens all the time. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that it takes all of this to really be a truthful and just person. When you give a promise to somebody, to hold on to it, it takes so much effort. It's not an easy thing. Now when Swami comes into the picture, right, we're talking about a promise which involves Swami, right? The moment Swami comes into the picture, I think it changes completely. It's a very, very different equation the moment Swami comes into the picture. Why is that so? Because when we talk of Swami, Swami is somebody who is beyond the senses and he is also beyond emotions, right? He's bhavatita, that's what we refer to God as, right? So even someone who is in perfect control of one's senses and oneself, and even someone who is beyond all emotions, who has become a vairagi, who is not swayed by any of the emotions, even such a person is not immune to Swami's touch. Right? Because we are talking of a phenomenon, we are talking of a personality, we are talking about divinity, which is beyond the senses and beyond emotions. So the moment Swami comes into the picture, even a person who is in perfect control of himself or herself cannot resist if Swami chooses to step in. And Swami would give this the example of so many great sages, like I think in the Ramakatha Raswayani, Swami speaks of Vasishta and sage Bharadvaja. They are supposed to be great sages who have got perfect control over themselves. And in fact, Swami would specifically say about Vasishta, he's a great sage, he's a Brahma Rishi. Being a Brahma Rishi, why does he become a sort of a Kula Guru or the preceptor for this clan of the Ikshvaku clan from where Dasharatha and Rama all belong to? Right? This is a royal family. This is a king. Why does Vasishta associate himself to a king when he does not have any needs? He's a perfected being himself. And Swami explains that through his vision that he gets through his spiritual attainment, he realizes that the Lord is going to be born in this particular clan, the Ikshvaku clan. And that is why even though he does not have any desires, he has gone beyond emotions, Swami says he is not able to resist the temptation of attaching himself to this royal clan, so that he will have the opportunity to have some sort of interaction with this avatar which is going to advent in this royal clan. And Swami would say, that is how irresistible the touch of the Lord is. And similarly, Swami would give the example of Sukha Maharishi, and we had recently spoken about it in extensively as part of the afternoon satsang when we did the Bhagavat Vahini satsang, right, where Sukha Maharishi is supposed to be someone who is born a jnani, right? He is born a jnani and he is born a renunciant. The moment he is born, he walks away to the forest. He renounces the world as soon as he is born. You know, that's the description of Sukha Maharishi. He's so perfect. He's what we call a perfect vairagi. He's completely detached. And such a person, Swami says that when Vyasa, his father, would relate stories from the Bhagavatam of the stories of the Lord, he finds himself tearing up and breaking down emotionally. And Sukha Maharishi tells this to King Parikshit. He says that this is what happened when I heard the Bhagavatam for the first time. And that is why even though he is beyond all of these things, when Parikshit wants to listen to the Bhagavatam, he comes. And actually Parikshit is looking for a means of doing the right thing for the last 7 days of his life. And Sukha Maharishi comes and says, listen to the stories of the Lord and that's the best thing that you can do. So somebody who is so much in control of one's emotions, one who is beyond his senses, one who has gone beyond the attractions and afflictions of the mind, even such a person, be it Sage Vasishta, Sage Bharadwaja, Sukha Maharishi, even someone like Adi Shankara, they are all, the moment God comes into the picture, they all become vulnerable in a sense, right? And that's why when we come to the point of Swami coming into our life, and when we start thinking of Swami, always we think of Swami only and only when Swami wills, right? This is something that we always say. This coming to Parthi or becoming a devotee of Swami does not happen because of our effort in this birth at least. It happens only and only when Swami wills. And when Swami decides to step into your life, decides to re-enter your life in this case for you, or come into the picture in any way, I think it is beyond our ability to resist that, right? And that is why if you go back into Swami's life and the devotees who have come to Swami, innumerable number of people who are sworn atheists, who are detractors of Swami, who are agnostics, who are communists, they've all melted the moment Swami decided to step into their lives. Because it's it's beyond human ability to resist this divinity who's actually beyond the senses and beyond any emotion whatsoever, right? So the question then comes, when does Swami step into our life, right? Or rather, whom does he choose to step, whom does he choose whose life he chooses to step into, right? The answer to that is when there is a bond that is beyond birth and death. That is why Swami comes into our life, because our relationship with Swami is not just to this birth. Though you say in your question that at the age of 10 that you came to know of Swami and that's when you started becoming a devotee of Swami, it's not just from the age of 10 that this bond with Swami is. It's a bond of many, many lifetimes. Right, I think there's an incident I'd quoted once when Swami had called a few students to the interview room. Swami was telling one of the boys, he looked at one of the boys and he was saying this, "Do you think that you have come to me just like that? Do you think that you have come to me just because of, you know, some sadhana that you've done or your prayers that your parents have done?" And then Swami went on to say in Telugu, he said, "Janma janmala bandhamu kadu. Janma 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 janmantara bandhamu." You know, the way Swami put it was with so much of emphasis. He said, it's not janma janmala bandhamu. It's not one janma or two janma or three janma. Swami said, janma 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 janmantara bandhamu. You have no idea what is your relationship with me, right? So when Swami steps into our life, it's not an accident. It is not a lottery. It's not like we have been picked randomly. It's because our bond with Swami is beyond lifetimes, right? Now, when we are talking about the idea of dharma, is it adharmic? Is the basic question that you raised. So what is this dharma? I spoke extensively last week also about it, but I'll repeat part of it. And part of what I'm going to say is a repetition of an answer that I'd given maybe almost a year ago, where there was a question about a husband and wife who have different views about spirituality and especially about God. It was, I think, about a Jewish couple where the husband was a very staunch devotee of Swami, but the wife was a very staunch Jewish. Her beliefs were that God cannot be worshipped in a form. So, you know, that was a conflict they were having. And that question was, what do you do when there's two people in a relationship have different ideas of spirituality and God? So part of what I'm going to say is a repetition of that. And those of you interested can go back and listen to that. There's a much more detailed answer in that. So what is this idea of dharma? Be it that of a wife, be it that of a mother, or anything, any of these relationships, it's nothing but a role that has been assigned to us, right? At that current moment, that's a role that is assigned to us. And typically, Swami would use this terminology called achara dharma, or achara dharma, I don't know how exactly it's pronounced, achara dharma. Swami would say, it is the dharma that needs to be practiced at that moment, in that given circumstance, and which is based on the role that you're playing as a wife, as a mother, as a son, as a father, or whatever it is, right? So it is nothing but the role that we have been given in that station in life. And Swami goes on to say that at any moment, you are playing multiple roles, right? At the same moment when you're a husband, you're also a son to a mother and father, you're also a brother, you're also a father, so you play multiple roles, right? So these are all different achara dharmas based on the different roles that you play. And what one has to play at that moment, Swami says, is defined by swadharma. And swadharma is nothing but personalized dharma, which is created drawing from these different achara dharmas of that person. As a father, as I said, different stations in life that you're simultaneously you're playing all those roles. So this concept of swadharma or this personalized dharma is created from these different achara dharmas that you are meant to play. Now all of these achara dharmas and the swadharma which is drawn from that is based on what I am right now. What I am right now in this particular birth. And this role that I am playing is but one tiny moment in eternity, isn't it? As Swami would say, Punarapi Jananam, Punarapi Maranam. We've been coming again and again and again. And that's the sad part. We're trying to end that now through our spiritual efforts, right? That's a different thing. But the fact is, we've been coming over and over and over again in different bodies, traveling through different situations and scenarios in different lifetimes, right? So this moment that we are living, this role that we are playing as a wife, as a daughter, as a daughter-in-law, or whatever it is, as a son, father, everything, this is nothing but just a tiny moment. It's a blip in eternity, if you could say that, right? So when you talk of a relationship of someone being a husband, right, or a brother or a sister or any of these relationships, this is but a momentary station in life in a very, very expansive eternity. However much all of these relationships are important to us, and our responsibility towards them is so very important, it does not take away the fact that these are all extremely momentary relationships. Yes, they are important. Yes, the roles and responsibilities that we have towards them is important. But nevertheless, it is a very, very momentary relationship. But juxtaposed to our relationship with God, our relationship with God, Swami said, is janma, 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 antara bandhamu, right? It's beyond countless births. And this is not only for those of us who have turned to Swami and not only those of us who are, you know, devotees of Swami. Because Swami would say that every being, be it a human being or animal form, or any being, Swami says, has this Atma within, which is the soul, which is essentially its true nature. And this Atma is divine, and this Atma is essentially God. And that's why Swami says that following one's Achara Dharma is very, very important. Though, I mean, multiple questions that we handle on this show is all about that. You know, what is my role as a wife? What is my role as a husband? I'm a father. I'm a parent. What am I supposed to do? And I'm an employee in this company, and this is the situation. What I'm supposed to do? All of these are Achara Dharmas. They are indeed important because that guide our present righteousness. What we are supposed to do, our current morality and righteousness is defined by all these Achara Dharmas. They're important. Following one's Achara Dharma is indeed important. But when there is a dilemma between the Achara Dharma and Atma Dharma, the Dharma that pertains to one's soul, Swami says, always Atma Dharma must gain preference or should be the one which guides our actions, right? And that is why Swami goes on to say, Swami defines Swadharma, the word Swa, Swami says, it actually refers to Atma. It is not merely a collection of different Achara Dharmas. At the end of the day, Swadharma is nothing but Atma Dharma. And that is why if there is any time there's a conflict between the role that we play as based on the relationships that we are having at that moment and a conflict between that and the Atma Dharma or our relationship with God, Swami says the preference always goes to our relationship with God. The other aspect of the idea of dharma itself, why are we told to perform our duty? Why are we asked to do our duty? The main reason is, the spiritual reason behind why we need to lead a dharmic life is because it's a path that leads us to God, right? That is the reason why dharma gets its importance. The path itself can never be more important than the goal that it is taking us to. The path gets importance because it is a means to reach the goal, right? So there cannot be any situation where the path becomes more important than the goal itself. In fact, this is one of the conundrums in the way we have looked at the Vedas and the Vedic rituals, which Swami would refer to, right? After the Vedas were accepted and after the yajnas and yagas were being done, Swami would often say this, you know, in different yugas, different things were given importance. So when a lot of importance were given to all these ritualistic forms of worship, especially yagas and yajnas, it almost got a life of its own. People started giving it so much importance that so much of diligence was paid for how you perform a rite, how you perform a ritual, right? So much so that people forgot that it is important because it is a path to a higher goal. So much so that the higher goal was forgotten and all importance was given to the path itself. And that is why Swami would say, as a course correction, great, you know, sages and saints like Adi Shankara come and they re-emphasize to the people that, you know, what is important is not the ritual itself. It is about the wisdom that is at the end of it. You have to finally realize that, you know, you're not this body, you're not this mind. You're supposed to realize that you are essentially divine. And that's what Adi Shankara says, because he's essentially looking at this mistake that was happening, that people were giving so much more importance to the path itself, forgetting what the path was leading to. And same is the case with what happens with the bhakti movement, where you have all these sages and saints like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, all the Alwars and Nayanmars in the south, or the great saints in Maharashtra. All of them come to rekindle this fire of devotion, because the process, people started giving so much importance to the process. Initially, people gave importance to the process, the path, because this is the path which is going to lead to God, so I have to be very careful and I have to be very diligent in the path. But over generations, that idea was lost and people were stuck with the diligence in the path itself. And that is why there was a course correction through these great sages and saints who came and said, you know, don't forget, don't be lost in karma. What is important is the upasana and the jnana, right? Those are the other aspects of the Vedic tradition. And those were the things which were being emphasized by these great sages and saints. There's another very, very beautiful analogy that Swami gives in the Dharma Vahini, where he says that bhakti is like a queen. Devotion, the idea of devotion is like a queen. And all of these rituals and rites and rules are like the maids of the queen, the queen's maids, right? And Swami goes on to say, the queen bhakti takes very, very good care of all her maids as long as those maids are serving her. The moment they start becoming arrogant or they start, there is an insubordination to the queen bhakti, Swami says that the queen dismisses those maids from her presence. And Swami goes on to say that is the same thing with bhakti and rituals and rites. You know, all these rituals and rites are meant to serve this bhakti. It has to lead you and it has to enhance this bhakti in you. If that is not happening, if there is a ritual which is demeaning this particular goal that you are looking for, which is bhakti, Swami says that rite and that ritual is no more necessary. It has become, it has lost its value. It can be discarded, right? And so the same thing can be extended to what we are talking about right now. All of these dharmas, the achara dharmas, our roles and responsibilities towards our family members, you know, these are all like the rituals and rites which Swami was referring to. So similarly, these are all like the queen's maids. They are meant to serve the queen. They are meant to serve this fundamental idea of us moving closer to God, right? And they get the importance. We have to be dharmic. We have to play our roles and responsibilities diligently, because it is a means by which we can get closer to God. So at any moment, we moving closer to God is being obstructed or becoming these achara dharmas themselves become an obstacle to our moving closer to God. I think Swami says that they have to be dismissed. You can always give priority to bhakti over any of these things. And that's why Swami explains this by giving this example. Swami would say, you know, a son should always obey the father. A wife should always be devoted to the husband. A disciple should always obey the guru at all times. A son should always obey the mother and keep her happy all the time. But Swami goes on to say, but more important than all of these relationships is one's relationship with God. And that's why Prahlada defying his father was the right thing to do. Meera leaving her husband was still justified. King Bali disobeying his guru did not bring him dishonor, but it brought him honor on the contrary. And Bharata disobeying his mother was considered noble. Because all of this are examples of the individual choosing this relationship with God, this need to move closer to God as superior to all of these things. Because all of these things are momentary relationships. Our relationship with God is actually the most eternal and it spans over time, right? What we refer to as my child, my family, it's such a very, very minute instance in this eternal journey that we're all part of, right? So now, can we safely conclude that God is more important than all our relationships? So whenever there is a conflict, we can choose God. And does that mean that we should just walk out of the relationship, or, you know, just tell them on their face that we don't care about the relationship, Swami is more important to us? So is that the right thing to do? Well, there's a small nuance in this which must be noted, and I think I'll explain that. See, in any of these relationships where we have duties and responsibilities towards the other person, or if I say, let's say at some point I say, I don't care about your opinion, or I don't care about what you want and what you like, I will just do what I like, right? That is when there is a rift in a relationship, especially when you talk about a relationship between a husband and a wife, where one says that I don't care about what you like or what your preference is, I will do what I want, right? And that is always seen as a way, an adharmic approach to that relationship, right? In the same manner, if I only think I want Swami, I want to be with Swami, anyone else who comes between me and Swami, I will disregard them and I will choose Swami. When we do this, doesn't our attachment to Swami also become just like another desire that we have? Suppose, let's say that there's another desire. Take any other example of, be it your business life or your professional life. When any of these things become an obstruction to the relationship, when a person says that, no, I want to do what I want to do, or this is what I am passionate about, I'll do it, I don't care about what you think. Now we are doing nothing but replacing that passion, that desire, with our attachment, passion and desire for Swami. Isn't that what we're doing? So when we do that, and when we disregard the other person's likes and dislikes, and when we say that, oh, I want Swami and I like Swami and I'm going to go after Swami, that, don't we make our attachment and our craving for Swami also as just like any other desire that comes and becomes a thorn in a relationship? So what is it that needs to be done to ensure that our craving for Swami does not become just another desire? Apart from saying that this is what I want, apart from saying that I want Swami, I want to be with Swami, I think we must also ask, what would Swami want me to do, right? What is it that Swami would want? If we are only thinking about I want Swami and I want to think about Swami all the time, I want to serve Swami all the time, then it just becomes another obsession, right? That's the problem with any form of love. We refer to that as objectification of love, where we consider the other person only as an object. If we want our relationship with Swami to be not in that manner, apart from saying that this is what I want, it becomes mandatory and it becomes important for us to also ask, you know, what is it that Swami wants, and strive to do that. So when we always keep that in our mind, we will not let go of Swami, of course, but at the same time, we will be more patient, we will be more tolerant, and we will put more energy into that relationship, right? We will work harder within the role. We will not let go of Swami, but at the same time, we will acknowledge that these are the things that Swami would want me to do. And that is how we do not make our craving for Swami just another desire which becomes an obstacle in our relationship. That's why we turning to Swami is always a means by which it strengthens us. It is not something which leads to discord or disharmony in our relationships. It must be something which strengthens our relationships, in the sense that it should make us more harmonious, it should make us more tolerant towards the other person, right? And that's why all these examples that Swami gives of Prahlada, Meera, or any of those kind of people, or even Vibhishana towards his brother, elder brother Ravana, they all tried very, very hard to work within that relationship or play the role to as much as possible to their abilities, right? And that's why, going back to the person who's asked this question, sister, I think what you're doing is the right thing. Of course, the question that I played out was a concise version of the question that she sent to me, and I can say this on the basis of what she had said otherwise in the mail, that in many ways what you're doing is right. You know, you say, after 23 years of marriage, now you're saying that I want to go out for bhajans. I think that's a sign of extraordinary patience, right? You have shown a lot of patience and you have worked very, very hard in the relationship, and that's a sign of that. And apart from that, whatever other things that you mentioned in the mail, how you try to work harder to ensure that it does not hurt the people who are involved, you know, when it comes to you going for bhajans or going for activities in the Sai Center. And certainly your husband is definitely being irrational when he tries to control your faith, right? You know, we are all living in democracies and we're very proud of living in a secular democratic republic, right? Why do we look at other nations which have a control over people's faith and say that, no, you have to worship only this God or you have to follow only this religion? We look at those establishments as being backward and narrow and being very intrusive. You know, they intrude into the privacy of the citizens and they are violating basic human rights. When that is how we look at political establishments, how is it right for a person in a relationship to say that I will decide who you worship or I will decide whether you worship or not? I think that's absolutely wrong, right? That's being an agnostic and is one thing, being an atheist is one thing, but forcing that attitude on another person for whatever reason, I think is not at all justified. So if you're asking me, is he doing the right thing? Is he doing the right thing and blaming you for being, for not keeping up your promise? I think this is something which is not the right thing to do at all. And if his complaint is that you gave a word and you're going back on it, and if at all he threatens to leave the relationship, then I think it shows that he has little respect for the word that he has given at the time of marriage, right? What we, at the time of marriage, what we take is referred to as the marriage vows, and it's all about I will not let go of you and I'll take care of you and all of that. So I'm not trying to put him down or I'm not trying to show him in poor light. I'm just saying that we're all given to this kind of hypocrisies and convenient philosophies. Most of the time we make up our mind and then the rest of the things that we speak and the rest of the things that we do are all only to support the view that we've already taken. But we think that our views are very rational and based on the things that we see around, but most of us actually are irrational. We've made up our mind and we conveniently twist and you know, whatever learning that we have for our own convenience. Well, the idea of atheism is a completely different thing. Maybe on some other occasion we'll talk about that. But in general, you know, talking about this journey with Swami, we all go through these different phases, right? One is Swami enters our lives forcefully. Many times, the problems that we face in life are like an alibi for Swami to walk in, right? Like in your case, the postpartum depression that you're talking about is clearly a situation that Swami has created to re-enter into your life. And in a way, it's a very strong message to your mind. I'm not saying it is to you, it is to your mind. At the age of 17, when you promised your future husband that, yes, I don't need Swami, I need you more than I need Swami, that's a choice that the mind has made. So when Swami is creating the situation and when Swami has entered your life, I think Swami is sending a message to your mind saying that, you know, he is the ultimate refuge at the end of the day. We can fill our life with relationships and achievements and wealth and attainments and all of that, but all of these can abandon us and become futile at a moment when we need it the most, right? And eventually we will find ourselves taking a recourse in Swami, turning to Swami. And clearly in your life, that's a situation which Swami has created to show your mind that, you know, you thought that you don't need me, you thought that you could do without me, but the fact is, at the end of the day, you will have to turn to me. And when I choose to step in, you cannot resist it, right? Then, in our journey towards Swami, there are phases where the environment around us is very conducive, right? It's very helpful for us to be devoted to Swami and helpful for us to grow in devotion to Swami. And Swami will give us good company. Swami will create the right circumstances and scenarios around us by which we are able to practice our love for Swami and devotion for Swami. We're able to participate in Seva and everything goes smoothly, right? That's a period when Swami gives us for our devotion to grow. Then there are phases in our life when our devotion faces obstacles or our devotion is challenged. It may be through, like the question that you asked, it may be through a hostile family environment or being in situations which take you away from Swami. It could even be a case of immense distraction in the form of success, comfort and luxury in life. When you are so lost in your worldly comfort seeking and luxury in life that you forget Swami, right? That is also a form of obstacle where Swami puts you through a phase where there are enough distractions to take your mind away from Swami. It is when we don't let go of Swami under these circumstances, when the situation around, the scenario around is not conducive for our devotion to Swami, I think that is when it is an opportunity for us to fortify this love. Really, the love for Swami, grows in the situation. I'd always think of this imagery. It's a very strong imagery for me. You know, when you make a pot of an earthen pot, right? How they do it is they make it with clay, and the clay is moistened, and the clay is made soft, and then they make the clay, and then they make the pot. And what do they do after that? The pot is put in an oven and it is baked, or it is kept in the sun and it is dried. Imagine we are making this pot. What is the reason we are making a pot? We're making the pot so that it can hold water. But what is the process for making this pot which is eventually going to hold water? We are trying to keep it away from moisture as much as possible. That's what we do when we are putting it in the sun. That's what we do when we put it in the oven. We are putting it in a situation, in a circumstance where there's going to be no moisture at all. And look at it from the pot's point of view. The pot might be thinking, hey, you made me for holding water. Then why are you putting me through this process where I'm not able to hold it? I mean, where I'm not in contact with water at all. The reason is the ability of the pot to hold water becomes much, much more when it is put through this process where it is not given any conditions which lead it to any contact with water. Right? I think similarly, when there's a phase in our life where Swami gives all the right conditions for us to grow spiritually, but then Swami will put us in situations where all the support systems around are removed, all the reasons why we have to think of Swami is removed. If we continue to hold on to think of Swami, I think that is when our love for Swami gets fortified, and eventually we are prepared to hold Swami in our heart, right? And so I think that's the answer I wanted to give. And probably before I conclude, the last thing I wanted to say is, you were referring to about going for satsangs and being with like-minded people in the Sai Center. I just wanted to make this small point because last week when I was explaining, I had said that Swami had clearly told, I read out passages from Dharmavahini where Swami said that women don't have to go to satsangs, women don't have to do seva. They can just stick to their house and they can do their duties towards the family, and that is good enough sadhana. So the point I wanted to make is, what Swami says is, it is not mandatory for a woman of the house to do all of these things for the sake of spiritual progress. But at the same time, it is not forbidden. It is not that Swami says you should not do that. If in our mental makeup, if we feel that I need this, I need to go and interact with people who have the same amount of love and devotion to Swami, or I feel more peaceful and I am more saner when I am spending a little time in doing bhajans and going and attending study circles or whatever it is. If we feel that as a need, Swami does not forbid us from doing that. Swami just says that it is not necessary for a woman to do that. Similarly, like all of us being in Prashanti Nilayam, it is not that only if you are in Puttaparthi, if you're a Swami student, if you're in Puttaparthi, you will grow. Swami says that no, wherever you are, if you have love for Swami and if you're leading a righteous life and if you are living your life the way Swami wants you to, you're going to progress spiritually. But it is our choice that we wanted to stay with Swami and we thought that it is a better thing to do with our lives. So Swami does not forbid it, but at the same time, it's not necessary. So if you feel that going out and participating in bhajans like this is important, I think you're right to do that. But the summary of whatever answer I was giving is, I think whatever you're doing is right. You have been patient, continue to be patient and more tolerant. I'm not suggesting that you walk out of the relationship. You can still continue to give importance to your relationship, but always keep in mind, I'm doing this because this is what will make Swami happy. This is a path which is going to lead to Swami, and I'm doing this because this is what is going to make Swami happy, and this is my offering to Swami. And even though the other people might not appreciate it, I think that is clear in our mind, and probably that's the answer I thought of giving you. If you have anything more to ask, feel free to write to me. I'd love to explain further. Well, dear listeners, I promised to read for you a beautiful poem that Swami has written. I actually can squeeze it in, but then the poem is so beautiful, I thought, why not give it a little more time? Maybe some other time I'll read it out to you. It's a beautiful poem that Swami recites during his discourses. We'll keep it for another day where we can spend a little more time on it. And as always, I think I underestimated my ability to explain an answer for a complete hour. But thank you, Sister, for asking that beautiful question. It gives us a lot of opportunity to reflect on what Swami expects of us when we call ourselves Swami's devotees, and what is it that we need to do, especially when the situation around us is not conducive for us to hold on to our devotion to Swami. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. If you have questions that you'd like to ask me, you can send me your questions to prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID. The mails that you send to me are read only by me. So if you wish to be anonymous, do let me know. I'll not mention your name. Even otherwise, the confidentiality of your mails is guaranteed. I'm going to leave you with a beautiful song, a song which is part of one of the sports meets which were presented in front of Swami. The meaning of the song is very beautiful. I'm going to leave you with that song. On the other side of the song, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the Vahini Satsang, which is the last segment of today's Thursday Live. I'll join you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. with another question on another episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.
चलते रुकते नहीं बढ़ते साईं हम सफर बढ़ते कदम थकते न हम साईं के प्यार को पाले हम बढ़ते कदम थकते न हम साईं के प्यार को पाले